Okay, let's unpack this. This deep dive is heading straight into, a really major and, frankly, quite intense debate.
Yeah, it's a historical and theological one within Judaism. We're
Yay.
looking at the Zohar.
The foundational text of Kabbalah, its origin, its nature.
And our source material today, it kind of sets the tone immediately. It's definitely not a, gentle academic chat.
No, not at all. It's an article by Chen Shalov, the title, "A Barking Dog Does Not Bite." Yuri Hanania Shari, Book of Zohar, Heresy and Idolatry, Part 2.
Exactly. Just from that title, Shalov is coming in strong. Very strong. It's a polemic, really.
Absolutely. A forceful argument against the traditional belief, the one that says the Zohar was written by Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai Rashbi way back when.
Back in the 2nd century CE. And like you said, the title makes it clear he's responding directly to someone named Yuri Hanania Shari.
Right, who seems to be defending the traditional view, the Zohar's connection to Rashbi.
Precisely. So our mission here in this deep dive is pretty focused. We want to understand Chen Shalov's core arguments. Why does he believe the Zohar isn't authentic to Rashbi?
Why does he use terms like heresy and even idolatry?
And how does he try to take apart the counterarguments from Uri Shari? And crucially, we're sticking only to what's actually in this specific article.
Yeah, that's key. It's definitely challenging stuff because the language is so strong, so intense, but it gives us a really clear look into one side of this big disagreement.
A very specific perspective.
So let's get right to it. The heart of Shalov's claim. What's his main assertion?
His main point, the absolute foundation of his argument, is that the Zohar is fundamentally a book of heresy and idolatry. He doesn't mince words.
Wow. Okay. That's incredibly strong language. What brings him to that kind of conclusion?
Well, he claims it contains, and this is his phrasing, external filthy opinions.
Okay. Like what?
He specifically points to things he believes are borrowed from outside Jewish tradition. Ideas from Christianity, he says, and Greek philosophy.
And a big part of his case seems to be how the Zohar stacks up against other core Jewish texts, right?
Absolutely. That's central for him. He believes the Zohar directly contradicts and even denigrates the Mishnah and the Talmud.
Which are just foundational, the bedrock of Jewish law and tradition for centuries.
Exactly. So for Shalov, any text that undermines them is inherently problematic,
Yeah, Dylan.
deeply problematic.
Now he's responding to Uri Shari in this piece, Shari, who, seems to be defending the Zohar. Does Shalov actually engage with Shari's points?
He does, yeah, but really only to refute them. He presents Shari as defending the Zohar, its connection to Rashbi, and claiming Shalov is twisting sources.
Okay, and Shalov's response to that charge.
It's blunt. Very blunt. He says he doesn't just have one proof. He has, and I quote him loosely here, thousands and tens of thousands of proofs that the Zohar is heresy.
Thousands. So he feels the evidence is just overwhelming.
Completely.
Yeah.
And that any defense of the Zohar is basically unfounded.
Okay, so let's dig in some of that evidence he puts forward. Where does he start building this case against the Zohar's traditional authorship?
One of his primary lines of argument is what he calls historical silence.
Historical silence, meaning.
Meaning, he finds it really striking, suspicious even, that major rabbinic figures, the big names, make absolutely no mention of the Zohar for about 1,100 years after Rashbi lived.
Wow, 1,100 years. In a tradition that's so focused on passing things down meticulously, teacher to student, generation after generation, what does that kind of gap mean for Shalov?
For him, it's a huge red flag. He argues, look, if the Zohar really had such important Torah in it, such vital teachings, then hiding it for centuries would itself be a massive sin.
Right. Why would they keep it secret?
Exactly. Why would these earlier sages who dedicated their lives to preserving and transmitting tradition, why would they hide something supposedly so crucial from the Jewish people?
Yeah.
It just doesn't add up for him. It challenges that whole idea of continuous transmission.
He also touches on a letter, doesn't he? Something supposedly from Maimonides that some people might point to as an earlier mention.
Yes, he brings that up, but only to shoot it down completely. He calls it a clear forgery.
A forgery? Why?
He says anyone familiar with Maimonides' writing style, his way of thinking, would immediately see it's not authentic. He even calls the letter itself heresy. So for Shalov, it's not evidence for the Zohar's age, it's evidence of later attempts to, give it a false pedigree.
Okay, so beyond the timeline, the historical argument, Shalov also focuses really heavily on the content of the Zohar itself. He argues it clashes with Rashbi's known teachings.
Right, this is a huge part of his theological critique. He pulls out a specific teaching of Rashbi's from the Talmud. It's in Sanhedrin, 63b, and it's fundamental.
What does it say?
It says that anyone who associates God's name with anything else, basically, introduces any kind of multiplicity or partnership into the Godhead, is uprooted from the world. It's about the absolute, uncompromising unity of God.
A core principle. And Shaloff says the Zohar violates this.
Directly, in his view. He points to passages in the Zohar that describe God using terms like short-tempered or concepts like father, mother, son, daughter.
Mm.
For Shaloff, these specific terms, these familial structures applied to the divine, are explicitly pro-Christian. He sees them as introducing divisions or, you know, personalities within God that just fundamentally clash with the absolute simple unity taught by Rashbi and the sages.
And based on that reading, he gives the Zohar that label.
The Book of Darkness and Gloom, yeah. He sees these ideas as obscuring, not illuminating.
He also really zooms in on how the Zohar talks about the Mishnah.
Yes, another major contrast for him. He highlights that the Zohar uses, well, pretty derogatory terms for the Mishnah. Things like image struck by a stone or stone of depiction. Even peel or husk.
That sounds negative. How does that compare to what we know Rashbi thought of the Mishnah?
It's a sharp contrast. Shaloff brings up the Jerusalem Talmud, where Rashbi is quoted saying, studying Mishnah is incredibly important, more important even than studying the Bible itself, and just as crucial as saying the Shema prayer at the right time.
So Shaloff's point is, how could the real Rashbi, who valued Mishnah so highly, possibly write a text that seems to, well, put it down?
Exactly. It doesn't square for him. He also points out something else.
Oh, wow.
He notes the Zohar's idea that things the Mishnah calls impure or forbidden or invalid, the Zohar apparently links these to the evil inclination.
So it's suggesting parts of established Jewish law are somehow connected to negativity?
That seems to be Shaloff's reading of it, yeah. And maybe even more fundamentally, he brings up a claim in the Zohar about Moses himself.
About Moses?
Yes. According to Shaloff's reading, the Zohar suggests Moses was actually punished for teaching the Mishnah.
Punished. For teaching the oral law codified in the Mishnah.
Yeah. And that he should have taught secrets and hints instead. Shaloff argues that these secrets, in the Zohar's framework, lead to believing in multiple interconnected causes or divine emanations, each called by a divine name.
And for Shaloff, that's a problem because...
Yeah, because it completely contradicts, in his view, the core Torah principle of God's absolute unity as the single first cause of everything. He interprets the Zohar as implying worship directed towards, and this is his term, a short-tempered created God, which from his strict monotheistic perspective is just beyond problematic. It's heresy.
Okay. He also looks for clues inside the Zohar, things that seem out of place chronologically, right? Anachronisms.
Yes, exactly. Anachronisms. And a big one he points to is that the Zohar depicts Rashbi having conversations with Amoraim.
And Amoraim were? Remind us.
They were the sages who lived generations after Rashbi. We're talking about roughly 150 years later.
So it's like reading a text where Plato is chatting with, I don't know, Descartes. The timeline just doesn't fit.
Precisely. It's a major historical mismatch for Shaloff.
How do people who support the Zohar explain that apparent discrepancy?
Well, Shaloff mentions the explanation given by Rabbi Chaim Vital, who was a very prominent later Kabbalist. Vital suggested that Rashbi, through Holy Spirit, saw the souls of these later sages before they were even born.
Okay. And Shaloff's reaction to that explanation?
He dismisses it completely. Yeah. Calls it nonsense, a gross falsehood.
Why so harsh?
He finds it irrational. He argues only God truly knows the future in that way. For Shaloff, the fact that Vital even needed to come up with such an explanation shows that people knew there was a chronological problem. It highlights the anachronism, making it, in his eyes, clear evidence the book was written much, much later.
He finds another key anachronism, too, involving Christianity.
Yes. The Zohar mentions Christianity by name, using the Hebrew word Nazrut.
And his point there is...
Simple timeline logic again. Christianity, as a distinct religion known by that name, didn't really exist in the 2nd century CE when Rashbi lived. Seeing that specific word in the text is, for him, powerful evidence that must have been written centuries later when Christianity was well established.
He also draws a contrast with something Rashbi supposedly said in a midrash about the sons of God in Genesis.
Right. He cites a midrash, Bereshit Rabbah, where Rashbi interprets the sons of God from Genesis 6, not as angels, but as sons of judges. And Rashbi apparently puts a strong curse on anyone who does call them sons of God, and specifically curses the idea that angels fell and mixed with human women.
Okay, so Rashbi, according to this midrash, was strongly against that idea. And Shaloff claims the Zohar.
Shaloff claims the Zohar does present that very idea, angels falling, mingling with daughters of man.
So he asks the rhetorical question.
Would the real Rashbi curse his own views? For Shalov, it's a clear contradiction. He suggests that Zohar's authors were probably just unaware of Rashbi's actual stance on this and maybe picked up the idea from other external books.
Like the Book of Enoch, maybe?
He mentions Enoch specifically, yeah, which is considered outside the Jewish canon, and reading it is traditionally discouraged.
And tying all these theological points and inconsistencies together leads him to use those really strong labels for the Zohar.
Yes, that's when he calls it things like a pro-Christian, pagan, and detestable book.
Yeah.
He links the content directly to his rejection of its authenticity and its place within mainstream Jewish thought.
Okay, so we've covered his main claims, the historical angle, the internal textual stuff, the theological arguments. But this article, as we said, is a direct response to Uri Shari. How does Shalov deal with Shari's counterarguments?
Well, Shalov frames Shari's questions as foolish.
Okay, what were the questions?
Things like, why didn't Rashbi teach Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, known as Rebbe, the compiler of the Mishnah? If the Zohar's teachings were so important, why weren't they in the Mishnah? And why didn't Maimonides discuss the Zohar?
But Shalov says Shari actually missed his original point.
Exactly. Shalov clarifies that his question was much more specific, more focused. It was about one particular legal ruling found in the Zohar.
Which ruling was that?
The prohibition against wearing tefillin phylacteries on Chol Hamod.
Right. Those intermediate days of the festivals, Passover and Sukkot. They aren't full holidays, but not quite regular weekdays either.
Correct. And the Zohar treats wearing tefillin on those days not just as wrong, but as a really severe sin. It even uses the term cutting the shoots.
Which sounds serious. That term usually implies something like heresy or severe spiritual damage, doesn't it?
It does. It's very strong language. So Sholov's question is this. If the Zohar is from Rashbi, and it considers this prohibition so critically important, a major sin.
Then why wasn't this crucial law passed down? Why didn't Rashbi teach it to his students, his contemporaries, so it would become part of the established tradition?
Precisely. Where is the transmission? Especially since, as Shalov emphasizes, the actual historical practice before the Zohar became widely known, which he puts around the 13th century.
What was the practice then?
The common practice, documented by earlier authorities, the Rishonim, across the board, was that Jews did wear tefillin on Chol Hamud. It was standard practice.
So for Shalov, the fact that this supposedly severe prohibition from Rashbi was completely unknown and unpracticed for over 1,000 years is a massive problem for its authenticity.
A huge problem. The lack of transmission is the key issue for him on this point.
Okay, so how did Uri Shari try to answer this, or at least the version of the question he thought Shalov was asking?
Shalov explains Shari's attempt. Shari apparently argued that Rebbe, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, was just a child or maybe a youth when Rashbi was teaching, so maybe Rashbi didn't teach him this specific thing.
Okay.
And Shari cited a passage from the Talmud, Reuven 13b, where Rebbe says he gained sharpness because he saw Rabbi Meir, who was Rashbi's contemporary, from behind, Makara.
From behind. And Shari took that literally.
According to Shalov, yes. Shari interpreted it as Rebbe literally seeing Rabbi Meir's physical back. And apparently, Shari even tried to link this to some Kabbalistic ideas about rear-facing or couplings.
Mm-hmm.
Shalov uses pretty dismissive language here, calling them filthy couplings.
Right. And Shalov obviously disagrees strongly with that interpretation of from behind.
Completely. He gives a detailed refutation based on classical commentators like Rav Hanimal.
What's the standard understanding of that phrase?
The standard understanding is that the Talmud is praising Rabbi Meir's teaching and Rebbe's intellect. From behind simply means that when Rebbe was young, he sat in the back rows of the study hall. Makarov refers to being at the back of the assembly, further from the teacher, not seeing his physical back. Students always face the teacher.
Okay, so a standard classroom setup, basically, sitting in the back.
Exactly. And Shalov points out something ironic here.
What's that?
He says Shari's incorrect interpretation actually strengthens Shalov's original question. Because if Rebbe learned from Rabbi Meir, even from the back rows, and Rabbi Meir was Rashbi's contemporary, then if Rashbi had this super important, severe prohibition about tefillin on Chol Hamud, why didn't he teach it to Rabbi Meir?
And if Rabbi Meir knew it, why didn't Rebbe, his sharp student, learn it from him?
Exactly. The chain of transmission is broken no matter how you slice it, according to Shalov. The fact that neither Rabbi Meir nor Rebbe seem to know or transmit this law points, for Shalov, directly away from Rashbi as the source.
So his conclusion on the tefillin issue is?
That this prohibition, found in the Zohar, but absent from earlier tradition, is not from Rashbi. He actually frames it as part of a malicious and cursed plan by cursed sorcerers aimed at making Jews miss out on the mitzvah, the commandment of wearing tefillin for about 10 days every year.
Wow, okay. Very strong conclusion there. Finally, Shalhoub tackles an argument sometimes used to defend the Zohar, right? The idea that its difficult passages are just parables or secrets.
Yes, he addresses that claim. He sees it as an attempt to, in his words, blind the public or sidestep criticism.
And he refutes it. How?
With two main points. First, he asks, if the Zohar is only parables and high secrets, why do people derive concrete, practical laws from it?
Like towers and towers of Halakot, as he puts it.
Exactly. Detailed legal rulings. He mentions laws derived from Zoharic concepts about figures like Samuel and Lilith. And crucially, he asks again, why would anyone abolish a commandment like wearing tefillin on Shul Hamod based on something that's supposedly just a parable or an allegory?
The practical application seems to contradict the claim of it being purely metaphorical.
That's his argument. If you're changing actual religious practice based on it, you can't just wave it away as a mere parable when challenged.
What's his second point against the parable's defense?
He points out what he sees as a kind of hypocrisy or inconsistency.
In what way?
He says proponents of the Zohar will claim its own ideas, even ones Shalhoub finds problematic or filthy, are really profound parables or high secrets. But then he argues, these same proponents often take classical rabbinic teachings, say from the Midrash or Talmud, and interpret them very literally, very physically. He calls it stripping and materializing.
So applying different interpretive rules depending on the text.
Yeah, he finds that approach contradictory. Using a metaphorical lens for the Zohar when its content is difficult, but a literal lens for other traditional texts.
Okay, so let's try and wrap this all up. We've gone through Chen Shalhoub's pretty intense argument. His core position is that the Zohar is a later forgery, filled with what he considers theological problems, historical issues, and therefore definitely not the work of Rashbi.
Right. He builds that case using several lines of reasoning. The historical silence for over a millennium, internal textual evidence like anachronisms mentioning Amorim, mentioning Christianity, and theological clashes with Rashbi's known views, like the descriptions of God or the Zohar's attitude towards the Mishnah.
And he doesn't just present his case. He actively refutes counterarguments, using that whole debate around Tepion on Shul Hamod as a key example. He uses its lack of transmission through figures like Rabbi Meir and Rebbe to argue it couldn't have originated with Rashbi.
Absolutely. And this deep dive into just this one article by Shalhoub, it really throws into sharp relief how different ways of reading history, of analyzing texts, can lead to completely opposite conclusions about a really major religious work.
It touches on some fundamental questions, doesn't it? Like, what counts as good historical evidence? How do you weigh a claim of hidden mystical knowledge against the physical evidence of texts being passed down or not being passed down?
And how much does the theological content of a text affect whether it's accepted or rejected within a tradition?
Yeah.
These are big questions.
Yeah, and here's where it gets really interesting, maybe for you, the listener. When you encounter these kinds of strong, conflicting claims about a really significant text, and again, this isn't just about the Zohar, this happens with many historical and religious texts, how do you approach it?
How do you weigh the evidence, the arguments from different sides? What kind of proof resonates most with you? Is it the historical detective work? Is it the internal consistency of the text? Is it how well it aligns with broader theological principles you hold?
It's a fascinating exercise, thinking about how we evaluate these complex claims about the past and about meaning. It's a microcosm of how we understand complex traditions and the debates within them.
It definitely highlights that understanding these things often means navigating some very passionate disagreements and really thinking critically about competing claims to truth and authenticity.
Well, that's our deep dive for today. Hopefully it gave you plenty to think about.